It's official. The big U.S. Senate race is set between Governor Rick Scott and incumbent Bill Nelson. The big deal for the district development on the South Bank heads to the full city council. And big controversy at the Duval County Health Department costs its leader her job. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to get our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, we're spending most of the hour with our very popular Friday Roundtable. You can get on the line now. Join the show at 549-2937. Then later, the cottages and courtyards of beautiful Amelia Island. Find out about this weekend's tour. That's all coming up, but first it's Friday and time to talk about the biggest stories of the week as we welcome David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
David Cotton of the Financial News and Daily Record is here.
Good morning.
Our own reporter Ryan Bank.
Good morning.
And in a moment, our contributor Fred Matthews will be along. It is Friday the 13th. He might have got caught in some traffic. Guys, we'll see him in a minute. Lots to talk about this week. Everything from a big flap over the CEO of the Duval County Health Department to a big step forward for that long-awaited development on the South Bank, the district. It's all coming up, but our top story this morning, Florida Governor Rick Scott stopped in town Wednesday, his first appearance in Jacksonville since announcing his long-anticipated run for U.S. Senate. Scott telling supporters at Ring Electric, a big donor to his campaign, that he will go to Washington as an outsider.
This is an exciting race. I'm going to work my butt off to make sure I'm the next senator from Florida. And when we win, we're going to make sure that we represent the state.
The race between Scott and incumbent Senator Bill Nelson is shaping up to be perhaps the most expensive U.S. Senate race in American history. It's going to be a barn burner as these two veteran politicians face off in this swing state. Polls are all over the place. When it comes to who has the lead, of course, Rick Scott trying to position himself as an outsider. But let's face it, he's a two-term governor who's going to be extremely well-funded. Will his campaign of running as an outsider stick? Can Bill Nelson capitalize on Scott's close association with President Trump among swing voters in the state? What about the Second Amendment issue in Florida? How will that play into this race? Lots to discuss here as we begin the hour with a closer look at Bill Nelson and Rick Scott running against each other. This is a Senate race both parties desperately want to win. Let us know who will get your vote and your thoughts about this race. It's 549-2937 to join us. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can weigh in on our Facebook page, too. David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union, let's begin with you. Right after Governor Scott announced his run, a federal elections complaint filed by a progressive group alleged that the governor used a pro-Donald Trump political committee that he chaired as a front to accept donations for his Senate run before he officially announced. We're going to be seeing a lot more of this as the campaign moves ahead.
It's going to be a huge, huge spending race, number one. And number two, that is a way for opponents of Scott to right away try and knock away at this idea, this image of him as a pure outsider, arguing that he's somebody who is trying to manipulate the system towards his own political ends. It takes a while for these things to get litigated, and who knows if there'd be even an answer or response or a resolution to that complaint before the campaign comes to a vote in November. But there is going to be a lot of campaigning for money. There's going to be a lot of campaigning about money and in terms of who's getting what money and how much. I mean, Scott's going to spend a ton of money.
This is being billed, David Cotton, as an epic battle between two battle-tested veteran politicians, Bill Nelson, Rick Scott. Pundits are also wondering whether the governor's close alliance with President Trump will be political poison in Florida or if he can turn that into an advantage.
Yeah, you know, you're dealing with two politicians, one who in Bill Nelson, who's not necessarily afraid to speak his mind at this point in his career, and Rick Scott, who doesn't really answer questions a lot of times directly. I think with the Trump bump there, Donald mm-hmm. Trump has already said at an event in Florida that this guy needs to run for Senate and has already kind of given a soft endorsement of that. I don't know if that will be the same type of, quote unquote, poison pill for Rick Scott, like it was for Roy Moore, mm-hmm. or some other politicians that have not fared so well. After Donald Trump has given them an endorsement.
It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Fred Matthews, both of these men have a record to run on. Scott, a record as governor for two terms. Bill Nelson has been in the Senate for several terms now and has campaigned and executed as a centrist moderate Democrat in this swing state. This is the first time Nelson has really strong opposition for re-election.
There's no question about it. I mean, again, Florida will be on Front Street. It will be center stage nationwide. Everybody will be watching this race. Why? Because we've got what we had on the national level. We've got a billionaire who's now a two-term governor running for what could be one of the valuable seats in the United States Senate. That means that Florida would have two Republican votes that they desperately need to have in Washington, given the fact that everybody else is leaving at a rapid rate on the Republican side. And it certainly will be a major test for Bill Nelson. The question here, this is a television race also, and it's a question of who's going to be able to look the best to voters when they show up on television, and we have probably, we won't get what about two debates out of these guys, but who's going to look the best? Who's going to carry their message the best out of this? And there's no question that the governor has the money to put his message on Front Street all over the state, all over the place.
Sure, hundreds of millions of dollars, and at the same time, Ryan Bank, Rick Scott is the governor in the nation that is most closely tied to Donald Trump. We've also seen a few special elections in Florida, the 40th state Senate district, St. Petersburg's mayoral race, Florida's 72nd state house district that have flipped from red to blue. Democrats are hoping for a blue wave around the country this fall, and President Trump will be the card that they play. Will that work in Florida?
So the first thing is, obviously, from the very moment that President Trump was elected, everyone in the state house and the state Senate to the governor's mansion were cheering this as saying we finally have an ally in the White House that can help us get things done. There was healthcare funding, the low income pool that they got immediately. And this is a reversal from the Obama administration that wanted to do away with that to push them into Medicaid expansion. So they've never really run away from the connection to Donald Trump. What makes this year different is, even though Scott is tested in winning very, very close elections, both of his elections for governor were very close. The difference here is that there is a possibility that Donald Trump is a motivating factor to get Democratic turnout in higher numbers than we had seen in his previous elections. So that's basically the wild card. If the Florida Democrats can get their voters out in more numbers than Republican voters, then you might see a situation where Bill Nelson easily holds on to his seat. But otherwise, it's going to be a very, very close and hard-fought race.
And David Bauerlein, what about the gun issue in Florida? We saw this CNN town hall after the mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Senator Rubio appeared. Bill Nelson appeared. Rick Scott didn't appear. Legislation made it through the state house this last cycle. The first gun restrictions in the state in decades. How potent will this issue be, do you think, in this race?
You know, that's a great question. And I don't know, because basically Rick Scott took some positions that were not in line with what the National Rifle Association wanted the state to do in response to the school
right.
shooting, and has had some family members of students who were killed during that come out and support him, saying that he was a strong leader in that situation. And he could maybe argue that that's a case where he saw something and was able to work to get things done. He wasn't just pigeonholed into a particular position. Bill Nelson, I think, will argue that a lot more needs to be done at the federal level, and will try to bring a lot of that attention to the issue. And in the rural areas of Florida, that's a big issue in terms of mm-hmm. the turnout that Ryan was talking about, because the Republican Party will face a larger, energized Democratic base this time.
Sure. In a normal midterm, the turnout numbers would favor Republicans. This year may be different.
Certainly. I mean, there seems to be some momentum, at least. I mean, I can even tell on my Twitter feed, I can see a lot more activity socially from Democrats. You know, and Rick Scott got a lot of heat for not going to that public town hall. And his excuse was, well, I'm just going to get to work and I'm going to, you know, support any legislation that comes in front of me. And, you know, he threw a shot at Bill Nelson in that whole exchange as well. So I think Rick Scott did enough for someone who is running for Senate to say, well, I'm not bought by the NRA, but I'm still going to protect Second Amendment rights if it comes down to it.
Fred.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what he did. He blunted any criticism that you would have of him for not supporting any kind of gun regulation. Florida is the only state in the union that passed any kind of gun measure this year. He blunted that. He has been very pro-jobs. No one can argue that. And he's been on the job with it. I mean, a lot of the things that we would want to criticize the governor about from a Democratic standpoint, you just don't have a whole lot of ammunition there. Your biggest ammunition that, quite frankly, the Democrats are going to have and that Bill Nelson's going to have, at least at this point, is that you don't want to have two Republicans representing Florida. That's your biggest argument. If you're going to criticize the governor for anything, or you're going to criticize him for being pro-Trump, you know, I don't know if that's going to necessarily work. What's going to be the message that Bill Nelson's going to carry? What is the message that the Democratic Party of Florida is going to give Bill Nelson to help him carry it? Right now, the Democratic Party of Florida is still in as much disarray as probably the local Republican Party is. So, I mean, you know, that's the thing. What's going to be Nelson's message? Because the governor has blunted a lot of the tools, a lot of the criticisms that you might have here for him.
Well, and Scott does not have a rosy relationship with a lot of other Republicans, I think. I mean, Marco Rubio has come out and said, I'm not going to attack Bill Nelson.
Right.
I support Rick Scott, but I'm not going to attack Bill Nelson, which, you know, that's a sign there that says, well, that's not very cozy. I mean, and that's not anything new.
Well, they're not going to attack the president, but they're
Rubio and Nelson have always had a close relationship.
Let me just jump in. Rick Scott campaigned on a jobs message. He won re-election by about a point on a jobs message. So he has a record to run on there. Critics will say that his promises really didn't bear full fruit in terms of jobs and economic development. They can try to hit him on that. They can point to the deaths of 14 seniors at a Broward County nursing home after Hurricane Irma, the bridge collapse that killed 6 people in Miami-Dade County, some ethics scandals under his watch. Bill Nelson does have some material to work with, but as Fred pointed out, in the main, this is a clash of titans that will be coming up with these epic narratives trying to paint the other as the devil incarnate.
Well, you know what's going to happen is, and we're already seeing this, you can already see the digital ads coming out. I've seen them multiple times. The Democrats are going to hit Rick Scott on what they tried to hit him on in his last two elections, which is the fact that he was a healthcare executive for HCA, and he pleaded the fifth 75 times in the biggest case of a fine against a healthcare company for Medicaid fraud in American history. So they've already started. They've already cut those ads. And the nursing home one is definitely going to be a big thing. Guns, it may be something that plays well in other states, but a state like Florida that's pretty down the middle and pretty purple. And even in Democratic spaces, there's still a lot of support for the Second Amendment. I don't see that being a message that kind of wins the day for Bill Nelson. I think what
certainly
he has
not to, north of the I-4 corridor.
Right. And of course, Scott, at this, the first policy point that Scott has released right now, the first concrete thing has been that he wants to carry a bill, if he becomes a senator, to impose term limits on Congress. And of course, without even saying Bill Nelson's name, we know exactly who he's talking about. He's talking about Bill Nelson. He's painting him as a career politician. I mean, it's well within the Scott playbook to paint himself as an outsider and everybody else as career politicians that kind of need to go.
But will the voters buy that this time? We will find out. In the meantime, let's go to your calls. It's our Friday roundtable. Give us a call with your thoughts. 549-2937. Arthur is in Palatka. Hey, Arthur.
Hey, how you guys doing today?
All right, thanks.
I have a quick question. Now, what he did with that Trump, with that money that he got for his campaign, was any federal election laws or were any federal laws broken from him doing that?
Well, there's a complaint alleging that he did that. The investigation, I guess, will show whether that complaint has any merit. It was filed by a Democratic-leaning group, so we'll have to learn more.
Okay. And also, I would like to say, you know, he blamed everybody for that horrific shooting. But before that, I think Florida was like almost to the last with mental health in the country. So I think, you know, Bill Nelson needs to hit him with that. I mean, there's plenty of blame to go around for that horrific shooting. But I think people can, why was there next to nothing spent on mental health? Maybe if there was more money spent on mental health, that kid could have got some kind of help or he could have been committed or something, you know? So I think he's, there's plenty of, blame to go around. And I think he needs to, of course he never will, but I think he's a big part to blame. And I've been to some schools in Jacksonville. They don't have locked doors, regular glass. It's just a disgrace what he's done. And I have a prediction. I think what's going to happen is sooner or later, the Florida teachers are going to walk out on strike like in some of these other countries. I mean,
other states. Yeah, thanks for that, Arthur. Okay, so a lot there from Arthur down in Palatka.
The first thing is that the specific complaint alleges that there is a federal law that was broken, because if you are a federal candidate or even if you are considering getting into a congressional race, you have to set up a PAC that's called a Testing the Waters PAC. The Donald Trump PAC that was set up, the new Republican PAC that Rick Scott was the chief of, was not that specific type of PAC. And what they're alleging is, even though it was set up under the auspices of helping Donald Trump, it was continued as a front to earn money before he legally could do so, before announcing. And so that's what they're alleging. And of course, the only way to know whether or not there was a law broken is we'd have to see what is decided by the Elections Commission.
And you see how complicated that is to explain? Imagine.
Yeah, that's a hard campaign issue. What about his other points, Fred, particularly when it comes to Florida's schools, the teachers, the students?
Well, it's going to have to be the Democratic Party of Florida, and, of course, their candidate for the Senate is going to have to be upfront about this. He's going to have to be bold. Their message is going to have to be put, they have to put this out. Now, Senator Nelson has never had to run a campaign like this in, what, at least 10, 15 years. So are they up to the task of actually challenging the governor on this? Are we going to see those messages coming through? For the most part, Senator Nelson is a conservative Democrat. I think we can all agree on that. He's not a liberal Democrat. He's in the conservative Democrat mold.
He's one of the few old-style Southern Democrats in the country still standing.
And exactly. Governor Scott, however, is not in the standard Republican mold. He's of that new mold. Some people will say he bought his way into the governorship, but so did Bloomberg in New York. And of course, with what the president has been able to do, they're outsiders who've proven that they can make it. And that's what he's running on.
And David Cotton, David Barreline, polling on this shows a tie. Some polls are giving a slight edge to Bill Nelson. There's a Republican-affiliated poll that shows the governor leading. The polls are, it's early, in other words.
Yeah, it's going to be a very, very close race. I'd have a hard time seeing how Rick Scott can win election based on term limits. It seems like a gimmicky thing to sort of call attention to something.
It is.
And I have a hard time seeing that he's going to be viewed as an outsider who's going to go shake things up. I think he really shook things up as governor. He is an establishment Republican Party candidate pick. He's in the mainstream, and I haven't heard any issues.
Well, he wasn't
yet
when he first ran against Bill McCollum.
Right.
But he is now. Yeah.
8 years ago, that was a different case.
Sure.
Now he's part of the mainstream Republican establishment, and if voters want to support a mainstream Republican, that's who Rick Scott is.
Well, and Rick Scott, as Fred just mentioned, Rick Scott is part of this sort of newer brand of Republican that has a lot of money, knows how to spend money and knows how to target the voters that they really want to target with really pinpoint accuracy. And that's one thing Rick Scott's team is going to be very good at this time around.
All right. Lisa is in St. Augustine. Hi, Lisa. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Good morning. Y'all kind of touched on a couple of these while I was holding, but the three things I wasn't hearing from you guys in your discussion were environment, education, and women's rights, because the governor and Bondi have repeatedly, and the legislature have repeatedly tried to constrain the rights of women to make health decisions, personal health decisions, that really should remain outside of politics. And they've taken it to court and spent a lot of money trying to negatively impact women in Florida. And my big comment is my friends in Tennessee, we always joke that they wanted to send him to jail for what he did, and we elected him governor.
And you're talking about the medical issue before he was. Yeah, thank you, Lisa, for all of that. Cece in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Cece.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to say, first of all, I'm glad that you stressed the fact that Bill Nelson is a conservative Democrat. In fact, if he were a politician 30 years ago, he probably would have been considered a Republican. The Republican Party has marched so far to the right that it's really sad to me that a right-wing Tea Party Republican like Rick Scott is considered mainstream Republican. People need to remember how extreme right he is and how closely aligned to Trump he is, and how if he is elected, he will rubber stamp whatever Trump wants to do. And if that's what people want, and for the people who are saying that Bill Nelson isn't liberal enough, the liberals who are saying that, and the conservatives who are saying, well, he's a Democrat, remember that Bill Nelson is a conservative Democrat. And Rick Scott is an extreme right Tea Party type Republican. And so I think people need to keep that in mind when they go to the voting booth.
All right. Thanks, Cece. Dave in Nassau County. Hi, Dave. What do you think?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My thoughts are Rick Scott has spent the entirety of his term as governor denying climate science in the state that is going to be most profoundly affected by it. I'm curious to see what the panel thinks.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. And we're getting emails from listeners, too, saying talk more about the governor's record on the environment. That, do you see that issue, guys, coming up in this campaign?
But that is the issue. But the voters voted him back in knowing that. I mean, this state
that was 4 years ago.
Well, they've supported it. They voted legislators in that supported his agenda, and now you want to turn him away because you don't like a few things that he did on. Yeah.
I know, but that was a different political time period than what we have now. Because the big factor is, will the president's record on this and other issues, how will that impact this race?
Well, Florida's also had more big storms in that time period as well. So right. I think that issue is also more to the forefront.
Well, I was going to say, I think, too, that there's a difference between running in a statewide office and running for a federal office. There are certain issues that come more to the forefront in terms of reproductive choice, in terms of an environment, in terms of a lot of things like that, where the policy really is set at the national level. And so that makes a difference. And that's why someone like Rick Scott, even though he didn't have great personal popularity, was able to win governorship twice in a row. Then you get to the federal level in terms of those elections, and it's a different equation.
Okay.
You also have to remember that the Democrats, unfortunately for their strategy, don't have a lot of cards to play when it comes to the environment issue, because although Rick Scott in his entirety of his tenure as governor hasn't had the best record, we've seen cuts to the Department of Environmental Protection and water management districts and all these other issues. But this last year, we've seen the most money that's been allocated for Florida Forever in a very long time.
He has pivoted on this issue.
Right. And so the only thing that the only card they have is to call him what they have been calling him, an election year environmentalist. But will that play when Scott can point to dollars and cents that he's appropriated to environmental programs? It's the same thing with education. It's the same thing with the gun issue.
He's moved away from hard right positions. Yeah. In the last year on a number of these controversial issues.
He's vetoed almost nothing. thing this last year. So
all right. So as Fred pointed out, as all of you pointed out, it's going to be an interesting one. And we do need to move on and talk about some other news from the week. The number to join us here on the roundtable this Friday is 549-2937. And also making headlines this week, Duval County's top health official under fire. It's Dr. Kelly Wells. She's been running the county health department since 2013. And she was also serving as deputy director for the entire state. However, Dr. Wells was transferred this week to another position, demoted essentially, after a state inspector general's office investigation found that she violated ethics laws in hiring a relative. That relative later resigned. The report said her cousin, Andrea Sharp, got preferential treatment. Dr. Wells pushed for her to get a 61% salary increase before she even got onto the job. And other tidbits that came out in this IG report that was sparked by an anonymous complaint. And so this has sort of opened up to the public a little bit more about the inner workings of this department. Your thoughts, panel. David Bauerlein.
Well, she was definitely a rising star. And so this really was a unfortunate twist in a career that really showed a lot of promise.
Yeah.
And it's good to see the system worked. I mean, this was an inspector general report within the department. So I think it's some comfort that a person can make an anonymous complaint like this. It gets investigated. It gets followed up. And if the facts are what they are, action is taken.
Yeah, this is kind of like the example of nepotism when they teach you in school, you know, what not to do as far as putting your cousin in a place where and promoting them and giving them a 61% raise and or fighting for a 61% raise. It's just kind of like you think someone with that type of experience would maybe know better if these allegations are true.
There are very good reasons to have anti-nepotism rules in place. And we could talk about nepotism at the White House, which has come under fire, of course, but we won't we won't get into that right now.
No, please.
But Fred Matthews, you know, David Bauerlein pointed out, Kelly Wells was seen as a rising star. In fact, she was brought in to sort of clean up mistakes at the health department from her predecessor, Dr. Robert Harmon, I believe.
Yeah, it's a very disappointing bit of news community-wise because she was quite well thought of. And there were a lot of progressive things that we saw getting done and the partnerships that the health department has with other nonprofits around the city is a big plus. But we again, this just shows that we, you know, from the outside, we don't know exactly what's going on from the inside. And one of the things that a lot of government employees, and these are government employees, complain about is that they don't, that the folks in the higher up take care of themselves. And they don't take care of the rank and file members. And obviously, people were watching her from the moment she got the job. And this is, this just... not very much of an excuse you can give for this kind of thing going on and for it to be so blatant for it to be going on. And obviously the inspection of this has been going on for some time. She's quite frankly fortunate to even keep the job within the system.
She kept a job.
I'm sure
she,
that's what's
yeah,
next.
She took a pay cut, took a lesser position in St. John's County, but still within the system. Yeah.
She
yeah.
was even recently promoted to being part of the overall Florida Department of Health's regional governance. So we're talking about somebody who's fallen pretty quickly, and you know, actually under her tenure. We've seen, although there is a lot of work left to be done, we've seen a lot of things like STD testing rates go up. We've seen other disease rates go down. We've seen obesity go down. We've seen initiatives, and as Fred was mentioning, community partnerships that have increased the outreach of the Duval Department of Health with the community. And so it really is a fall from grace. I mean, it's not like somebody that we have wasn't successful in making gains in the department while she was there. So that makes it
right.
all the more tragic.
It is sad. It's very sad to see. Okay. We also want to talk about something else here. The massive and long awaited South Bank development, the district. We've talked about this a lot on this show. Well, the district is now just one step away from approval by the city of Jacksonville. The Downtown Investment Authority unanimously approved incentives for this project this week. It includes the city spending up to $26.4 million in infrastructure improvements and $56 million in tax rebates. I'm not good at math, but that's close to $100 million. Right, Fred?
That's a lot
yes.
of money.
The 30-acre tract used to be the site of the Southside Generating Station. It's right next to the Duval County School Board building, that big open piece on the South Bank. Now, the district would encompass nearly 1,000 residences, a nice hotel, a big retail space, more than 130,000 square feet, office space, and even a big marina. So a new place for people to put in, which that is exciting. So give us a call. Let us know. Is this a great piece of investment for the city? Or do you think it's corporate welfare, as critics have charged?
No.
549-2937, David Bauerlein. This is something that is seen as a win for the principals of the Elements Development Group. Michael Munns, full disclosure, he's my old boss, and Peter Rummel, the major developer. They'd been pushing for this, and now it looks as though they're on the road to getting the incentives they want.
It does, although maybe they're not necessarily the incentives they wanted. The first package didn't go through, but they are going to get incentives. I do think it will pass the city council, and it's going to be, if it gets built, a huge development, and it really could set the stage then for kind of a parameters what the city's willing to do on the other big tract of property downtown, which is the shipyards and Met Park that Jaguars owner Shad Khan wants to develop.
David Cotton.
There's certainly, I don't see this not going through council. I don't see council not approving this, but I think it will get some pushback in some of the committees that are led by people who are not supporting of the mayor. Garrett Dennis, someone who's the chair of the finance committee, who, as I think everybody who listens to the show knows, Peter Rummel is a donor to Lenny Curry, and I think that's going to factor in a little bit. But what I will say is this is a very straightforward deal compared to the 4.5-5-hour PowerPoint presentation that was given out in January, and everybody kind of left scratching their heads.
This is a straight-up incentives package, and the city has done other ones like this.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at it, I know the numbers are big, but, you know, it is relative compared to, you know, what they did for the Lower Street Trio and the Barnett Bank building, what they've done in other projects. Now, some will say, well, look what happened to 220 Riverside and Unity Plaza. That's not a great example of using city incentives to, you know, spur
right.
development.
But budget hawks will point to that. Like, for example, City Councilman Matt Schellenberg is really a strong critic of this and does not think the city should be in the business of funding these things. Ryan Bank, there are a few naysayers on the council, but as David Cotton pointed out, they probably don't have the majority.
No, they probably don't. And it's not going to be, I think the reason why this, why these naysayers are going to have a stronger voice really comes from the JEA debate that we've had. Because just like with the JEA debate, the district's wheeling and dealing kind of has had the same public outcry and a question of transparency. And so I think, yes, to David's point, like, I think you'll see Garrett Dennis, maybe Anna Broche, and a couple of people that have been thorns in the side of the mayor's office come out loud, but I don't know that they'll have enough power to shut down a deal like this. This kind of momentum doesn't just stop.
Well, I just don't see how they're going to have very much ground to stand on. The deal has been reworked from what it was in January, where the taxpayers aren't as much on the hook as they would have been with that deal before. Basically, the city was going to own it, and the developers were going to pay us back whenever they could. At least this way, it's a standard deal that we've given to developer after developer. It's what we're going to end up doing for the shipyards if we ever want to get it done. We've got to dig up the dirt and prove that it's clean before the developer can come in there. At least this way, you've got something that we've all been crying about for downtown. You've got a major, major development that could turn out to be as good looking as the town center.
And this is really, this is a two-part sort of project, right? They're going to form this community development district, and that's going to issue Rummel and Munns $30 million in bonds. And the way they're going to pay those bonds back with interest is going to be through vertical construction. The ad valorem taxes that are generated from that, 75% of that is going to pay for that. You know, they held two workshops with, you know, two lunch and learns with city council members. And, you know, I've only been covering DIA for about a year now, but that's the first real, you know, series of lunch and learns that I've been to for a DIA project. I don't know, David, if you've seen that before.
Yeah, that was a new wrinkle. And I'm not sure that some of the names of council members who have been mentioned as potentially being opponents are really going to be opponents on this deal. because the parameters of the deal are similar to the kind of incentives they've given before on other projects. It's obviously much more because potentially it's a much bigger project. It's not a guaranteed incentive. It depends on how much actually gets built.
Let's go to your calls now. What do you think about city incentives for the district? 549-2937. Florence on the east side. Hi, Florence.
Hey, good morning, everybody. I watched Alex develop 220, and I've been watching
Alex Foley.
Peter.
Yeah.
Okay, Alex Foley.
Yeah.
Yep, sorry. And I've been watching Peter work on this. I remember Peter talking about this at once at not only once for ARC, but at TED a couple of years ago. And the concept of back then, I haven't been involved in the most recent Lunch and Learns of what he's talking about of the long-term social impacts. Someone said it's looking, from all parameters, really supportable. What I'm really interested in is being able to hold the team accountable to the things that they're saying that they're developing on that side of the woods. So if, in fact, it's going to be a sustainable community and it's all about health, I want to know the factors that are talking about waste management. I want to hear about the properties that every business that comes into that sector is responsible for, how much waste they manage, where does the waste go, lots of the impact. So I'd like to hear a little bit about what are the ways that we're going to hold that money accountable, which I believe we can. I really believe in this project. Yet I watched other businesses in our community get money and then not be held accountable to the parameters that they were asked to. 220, Intuition, there's a handful of projects in town that got money from us that aren't being held accountable to the things that they said they were going to do in that community when
we
gave them that money.
I hear you. And I got that name wrong. It's Alex Coley. Yeah. Thank you, Florence. Yes. Yeah, the 220 Riverside development, the Unity Plaza development in Brooklyn, that almost went into foreclosure, and it was taken by the bank in December of last year. And what about her other comments?
Well, there's nothing in the development agreement that has anything to do with the, quite frankly, the healthy town aspects of this development.
Right.
It's a mixed-use project. It's got a lot of different uses all together within walking distance. That's not exactly transformative. I mean, it's been done before all over the city. So, and there's not anything in there that requires any particular standards to be met in terms of health or management of waste. So I'm not sure that was ever part of the proposal, but it's certainly not something that's part of the formal agreement that's being done between the city.
And that's one of the things that we all have to recognize. These are privately owned companies. These are businesses. All they're doing is coming to the city and saying, you've got the land. We would like to put something on it, develop it. And the city is saying, okay, you're right. We've got the land. Here's how much it's going to cost. Here's what kind of breaks we're going to give you in terms of tax incentives. But how you run your business, ultimately, how Mr. Rummel and Mr. Munns run this business is going to be up to them. And how they're held accountable for environmental issues is going to be up to the city council persons and the neighborhoods that are around that to hold them accountable to doing what they said they would do. But as far as the deal itself, it is not part of the package.
All right. And let me just jump in quickly. One other note from the week. Former UNF president, actually, he will soon be former UNF president and former mayor John Delaney announced he is joining the strategic alliance between the Rogers Towers law firm and the lobbying firm, the Fiorentino Group. They represent the parent company of TECO, which is a utility that could be interested in buying JEA. David Cotton.
Yeah, I spoke with John Delaney yesterday, and I asked him directly, are you going to be lobbying for Emera or TECO? And he said, well, I'm not sure yet. Marty Fiorentino said, I hope so. And so we got an updated story there on jacksdailyrecord.com where we talked to John Delaney yesterday about that directly.
Okay, so we see this prospect then of an effective former mayor and university president turning his talents toward potentially the most controversial issue facing the city right now. Should this utility be privatized?
That might put some extra wind and at the backs of whoever is pushing the sale, because nobody's officially taken actual credit for pushing it. As we know, the mayor's office is continuing to deny that they want a sale of the utility. Others think differently. However, it's really hard. I mean, at my last count, right now we're looking at 10 votes that are pretty positively going to be opposition to this plan. You need a supermajority vote, of course, to even begin the process of privatization. So can John Delaney lobbying for an effort like this change those 10 minds? We'll see.
So we've already got John Delaney as a lobbyist at the front end of the stick, and he hasn't really gotten into the job at Rogers Towers yet.
we'll have to see. But it was interesting to note that good reporting up from David Cotton on that. Thank you, David, for pointing that out. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida does a guy get a date for the prom by putting up a message on a Chick-fil-A sign. Yeah, maybe he could have asked John Delaney to lobby for him, but
he's
no.
He's won my heart.
This guy in Seminole County named Tanner Waters, who was working at the restaurant, was stressed out about his dateless status for the prom. His manager took pity on the kid. He took a picture of the sign outside Chick-fil-A advertising Tanner's availability to squire a young lady to the prom. His fellow employees posted pictures of Tanner on social media. The good news, it worked. Tanner Waters now reports he has a selection of dates to choose from.
This is a really nice story, but can we get to the real crux of the matter? Are they going to open on Sundays? I would like my chicken. I would like my waffle fries on Sundays.
Unfortunately, no. Okay, and then finally, only in Florida can you get a $13 tattoo on Friday the 13th. Yes, there's no better way to commemorate the spookiest type of Friday than to get some painful body modification on your skin. Getting tattoos on Friday the 13th is a tradition among millennials who want ink that won't break the bank. There are a number of places around town where you can get a $13 tattoo today, this Friday the 13th. Don't forget to tip your tattoo artist.
So First Coast Connect tattoos?
There you go. I'd be all for that.
Let's go.
I have a tattoo. It's just not in a place where any of you guys can see it. So.
Oh, man.
I'm not going to say anymore.
TMI.
Yeah, that was probably a mistake. Okay, Fred Matthews, David Bauerlein, David Cotton, and Ryan Bank. It's so good always to have you here. And have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
In a moment, we'll go up to Amelia Island. It's a fundraiser for the Amelia Island Museum of History this weekend. We'll tell you how you can check out the most beautiful cottages and courtyards on the island. That's in a moment. We will be right back.
Metro Rooter specializes in residential plumbing, including tub, faucet, and toilet repairs and replacement. Emergency plumbing 7 days a week with Saturdays considered the same as weekdays. Proud of their many longtime employees, Metro Rooter also recycles for a healthier planet. MetroRooter.com. May Management Services, specializing in condo and homeowner association management. Celebrating 30 years in Northeast Florida since 1988. More at maymgt.com or 461-9708.
West Virginians love President Trump. He won 69% of the vote there. So if you're running for senator, smart move to cozy up to the president.
I'm the only candidate that actually endorsed President Trump in the May 2016 West Virginia primary.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The wild primary fight underway in the heart of Trump country. Plus, the week in politics this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air.
It's my life, it's now or never.
We feature our interview with Jon Bon Jovi, who's being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on Saturday. He's been performing since the 80s when he had the hits It's My Life, Living on a Prayer, You Give Love a Bad Name, and I'll Be There for You. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Where do you start with the news this week? Search me.
It's an attack on our country in a true sense.
Investigating your personal lawyer is certainly not an attack on our country.
Mark Zuckerberg shows up, Speaker Ryan heads home, and Tammy Duckworth makes history as a new mom in the Senate. The Friday News Roundup next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, this weekend, it's your chance to discover a hidden side of beautiful Amelia Island. The island has gorgeous historic homes and gardens, and you can tour some of them this weekend. Jennifer Harrison is with the Amelia Island Museum of History. She's on the line now with more about this Saturday's Cottages and Courtyards tour. Hey, Jennifer.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's so good to talk to you. Now, of course, Amelia Island is known for its holiday home tour at the holidays, but you've got something happening this spring, too. What's on the agenda?
We thought this would be a really nice thing to complement our holiday home tour, which is always on the first weekend in December. And this year, that's going to be back at the beaches, which was a great success. People loved looking at the beach homes for a change. But we thought sometimes we just walk past a lot of lovely cottages on our way to visit the historic homes. So we're having this Cottages and Courtyards tour just on Saturday, one day only. And it's going to be from 10 o'clock till 4 o'clock on Saturday, tomorrow. The weather promises to be absolutely fantastic. It's a gorgeous day up here. We have 9 beautiful little cottages and 3 additional very colorful, attractive courtyards. And, of course, the cottages themselves have little courtyards. So it's a wonderful day out for everybody to come up here and enjoy being in Fernandina, have lunch, shop a little bit on Center Street, visit these delightful cottages. They are all south of Center Street, for those who know Fernandina. They're all within walking distance of each other. And everyone is a gem. They are very, very different. The oldest dates back to about 1905, and the most recent is 2017. The owners are a wonderful group of people. They've been so cooperative. They are the most interesting group, all with different backgrounds. We have artists, a lawyer, a photographer. We have former cruise ships entertainers. We have school teachers. We have a member of the Lighthouse family. It's just a wonderful group of people who have brought their interests and their passions to these little cottages and really personalized them and made them individual. Each one is an absolute gem.
Well, it sounds delightful. And as you pointed out, hopefully a beautiful Saturday for this. And this is all to support something important, the Amelia Island Museum of History. Tell us about that organization.
Well, it's a wonderful organization. Our museum is an absolute little gem. Really, when we came here full-time about 12 years ago, I wondered how I was going to fill my time with interesting things to do and listen to, but the museum has been a wonderful place to get to know people, and it's just a good place to come and visit, and maybe visitors for the day will even have time to go around the museum. The tickets are on sale at the museum today, and also at, if you know Fernandina, Peter Brooks Chocolatier, close to Publix on Sadler. They're selling tickets today for $15. Tomorrow, tickets will only be on sale at the museum on South 3rd Street. And or you could go online to www.ameliamuseum.org, and get yours ready for pickup tomorrow. So I think it's just going to be a day that people could remember, a day out in Fernandina, a nice lunch, lovely cottages, wonderful yards, and it's a beautiful sunny day. What more could we ask for?
What more could you ask for? Exactly. It sounds amazing. And it's, if you've never been up to the historic district on the island, this is your chance. It's tomorrow, the Cottages and Courtyards Tour, the first ever on Amelia Island. As you get the chance to visit in this walking tour, 10 beautiful homes and courtyards. Get your tickets online, as Jennifer mentioned, at ameliamuseum.org or at any of those other locations. Get on out and enjoy a beautiful spring weekend on the island. Always good to spotlight Amelia Island on this show. Jennifer, thanks so much for getting on the line with us. Have a great time
Thank
out there.
Thank you. Thanks, Melissa. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Coram runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. We always value your feedback, too. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to tune in at 1 o'clock this afternoon for our look at the biggest stories around the state, the Florida Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. 1A is up next, but if you're listening to our 8 p.m. rebroadcast tonight, just stay tuned for music. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday, and enjoy your weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.